video game parlors instead of school where they should be, right?
Well, they'll see enough once the world government structure is obsolete, and as we change our percepts rapidly, they'll begin to get the process pattern recognition of seeing what McLuhan was talking about, the effects of the electric environment. That'll become a cliche situation. They'll turn that book, Four Arguments Against Television, into a Bible. Marshall McLuhan hated that book because he was beyond that. But the you can see where they're going to try to use McLuhan and move from eco-fascism into media fascism.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So what is the psychic control?
Psychic fascism?
You see, that's what Dave, you know, Dave, the old dialoguer about the psychic was more powerful than the electric, right? Remember Dave, the food guy, Baldwin Foods. Is he dealing with a world, was he dealing with a universal government problem? You know, in the sense of how do you have psychic ecology?
Yeah, psychic ecology. Well, that's like the war between the Axis and the Rai.
Ah, good point. The battle between the cosmic awareness and
it
the...
It might get back to sort of a Darwinism thing of the survival of the fittest. And so you've got the fittest psychics cleaning up the backyard for us all.
Well, it becomes a battle over what is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the battle between cosmic awareness and the evergreens.
Yeah, you look at Toronto, and it's just swamped with all these...
Okay, now what's these interpreters?
Yeah.
Yeah, psychics. Now, this universal government is already being acted out. As I said, it was locked down from 1960 to 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is mythic government ecology? What will be the mythic government which comes after the universal government situation? See, mythic government is realizing consciousness is in the apparatus you use. The cyberpunk dimly perceives this with his virtual reality addiction and fetish, right? They realize that technology is a drug or is a stimulator of consciousness. So we don't know where the conscious becomes. It no longer will be a battle between the conscious and the unconscious. It'll become whether you perceive something or not, and then the quality of that perception, and you'll need an object, an environment to perceive something.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a battle of sensory awareness.
What? Yeah, it'll be a battle of awareness, of sensual awareness.
Of consciousness, the forms of consciousness, the external environment becomes mythic again, becomes archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
This is, see,
so they'll be fighting about total environment, but the surrounding environment, as opposed to, you know, items.
Well, people will become their automobiles or whatever technology is available. They'll hoik that up as the real source of consciousness. Humans will willingly defect into technological matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sean, I have to give you a credit for this. You haven't even heard us lay this map out two shows ago. And Mike, this guy is stimulating a new dialogue about these structures already. This is very good, Sean.
Yeah. You know, I saw this, I can't remember where I saw it, but it was in a German newspaper or something, but the Pinks have got like a physical prototype for that cyberpunk thing with the total immersion in cyberspace.
Yeah.
They're using it down at NASA now for training pilots. They create a three-dimensional hologramic image that with total environmental surroundings.
Well, that's what Mondo 2000 is promoting. The people who developed that have now marketed that for private consumption. You now can do that with your own goggles.
The Pink's got to act that out. They can't, they can't just, you know, jam with it. They have to create something. The same thing with the, you know, what you were saying a long time ago about time travel. You were saying that to the Canadian Beaver there.
Yeah, that language is time travel.
With a time machine because they don't realize that.
Language is time.
Yeah.
Now this comes, see, since man is language, and we now define all technologies from speech to zippers to bulldozers to virtual reality technologies as linguistic.
Mm-hmm.
And language is myth because the original meaning of myth was word. So languages and technologies are words. Words are myth. That's what I mean by mythic government. The mythic battle is what word, what technology, as they merge, are you going to put on?
So it's like a battle of words there.
Battle of clothing.
That's what the Exits were talking about in their latest, you know, bulletin. You know, they send out their memos.
Yeah.
They were talking about that in their latest memo.
About what?
Language. What is language? And the use of language to create total environments in the self.
Yeah. Now that's, is that the core belief engineering?
Yeah, no, it wasn't the core belief engineer, you know, the message from the Axis.
Okay, I haven't checked that out. But see, that they're trying to putting the matrix, the forming of consciousness, their bias seems to be that language creates a reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I could use a pencil. If I hold up a pencil to define my reality, that a pencil involves and implies so much other aspects of its environment.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we've got to remember that not just speech or thought is language.
Mm-hmm. On the sound.
Your clothing is language.
Yeah.
And it is an organic animal clothing. It's as we wear this electric environment as a new lung, as I've often said.
So every media, but each word is a media as well.
That's right. And
so
that's
that
right.
You can affect the environment, and that's like the interplay between the medium, you know, the figure-ground relationship, that the words act in a figure-ground.
Excellent.
That
right.
Every time you speak, you're, you know, in dynamic interplay with your ground.
I'll use them in words.
And I think we can interact with the ground of your environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, therefore, every word evokes every other word.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, every technology evokes every other technology. That's why you can't stop technological evolution, because once we had the first technologies, which were whatever you want to say it was, the chicken and egg, all
mm-hmm.
right, gesture or speech, it
mm-hmm.
implied every other subsequent technologies. So
yeah.
The evolution of technology is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if every word invokes every other word and every other technology, then you can just use one word, and that's the word we use, Bob.
Bob, yeah.
See, so that's what Bob's about, and that's what David Lynch is trying to discuss in his Twin Peaks interval question mark with a double duty interrobang bang thrown in.
Okay, so you've got technology. Every technology implies every other, and the same goes for word, right?
Yeah.
Does that go with it? So you get an interplay between the two, that every word implies every technology and vice versa.
Yeah.
So that forms almost a, you've almost got a tetrad there between. Now that's all, that's a dynamic, that's not.
Arch the
dialectic.
Yeah, that's a dialectic, we need something with four.
Well, the tetrad is the process of the retrieval. You use one word, it evokes other words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, the dialectic is a smooth visual space, it's homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
You say, one word evokes all others. Well, the tetrad's a more sophisticated view of that process because it's almost scientific. You look at the word and you see what it particularly evokes of all the possibilities in that particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
What it retrieves, what it obsolesces, what it flips into.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
That's why I was saying that cosmic awareness is lost the battle.
With the evergreens?
Yeah, because the cosmic awareness was caught in that dialectic. They were looking at effects and this battle.
Causes and effects. Yeah, they certainly didn't have the tetrad process, which the evergreens are aware of.
Yeah, because cosmic awareness worked on, exactly that.
And look at cosmic awareness promotes Bill Cooper and the evergreens doesn't.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because that's what I thought was, as soon as I started reading it, that it was, you know, it was kind of fishy sounding.
Right, but remember, every truth...
It sounds so corny, it's cliche, right?
Right, but every truth evokes every error, and every error evokes every truth. So the cosmic awareness has a function.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not saying they don't have a function, I'm just saying that.
But when you're looking from the mountain,
when
you're looking from Bob's view, you put it aside and focus on the evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic, Sean, to talk about this.
Okay.
Okay, Mike's giving the signal.
Yeah, I'll let you go.
So, great return.
You can be around later on, maybe I'll give you a call.
Yeah, we got some good stuff. We got Dan Sheehan talking to Dave Emery.
Okay.
Real good stuff on Ken's show.
Okay.
What's the time, Mike?
10 to 1. 10 to 1.
Cool. Okay, Mike, that was, I think I have to congratulate Sean for performing awesome, very good percepts he evoked immediately after a four-month fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think he might be a contender for the Media Ecological Award next week.
Of the month?
No, of the year.
Well, this has been an interesting show. You haven't allowed many calls to come through, so how do you approach the... we've had calls waiting all night, though, and a lot of people have hung up, so...
Well, they get the chance next week.
But they don't, though. You've got to keep it, you know.
Oh, listen, we did the fast pace last week. You can't have the same thing.
You've got the fast pace every other week, Bob. It's every other week. You've got to
reach out. Yeah, we had the fast pace last week. Okay,
last show.
Okay, we had the slow pace today. We have the fast pace next week.
But you know, people complain about not being able to get through. It's because we spend
half an hour on a week. We got forever. They should be listening to the sub-geniuses who did get through.
Right.
Okay, you got to give Sean and these guys. We had new callers tonight, except for Ed. Okay.
We had one new caller. We had three callers. One of them was a new caller.
Yeah, but Sean was new. I mean, he's reporting in on the effects.
Well,
of
we only have
time
for one more call, so we'll go to one more call.
Well, it might be fast.
That's it. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I was on hold like 2 seconds.
Amazing.
I wasn't in line there.
That's incredible.
Oh, well.
I guess I just took the wrong call.
It happens every time.
Well, listen, Dave, the topics we talked about tonight, especially with Sean, resonate with what your buddy said 2 weeks ago.
Which one?
The one who was worried about technology and the Luddite effect and how could we even consider technology since the insects in first nature is dying rapidly, the death of species. Remember that caller? Anyways,
anyway.
The guy who said he wasn't like his father.
Right.
All right, remember that
right.
guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to ask him, Mike, he mentioned after that call that he was reminiscent of someone. Burroughs? Was it?
When? After the Sean?
After that caller last week. Who read the stuff backwards?
Oh, yeah, that was another guy, wasn't it?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but no, I suggested it was Burroughs.
Yeah.
And Mike agreed with me, but the caller said, no, not really. Right, Mike? You remember that the guy read the verse backwards?
Well, Burroughs did similar to Finnegan's Wake, except he would use newspapers. And he spent half his life cutting clippings out of newspapers and putting them together in new ways to make new information, and that's sort of how he based his how he wrote his novels.
Yeah, so he's not a mixed corporate media author because he had a visual bias. He visualized tactile and kinetic space, whereas Zappa, LaRouche, McLuhan sculptured it. Sculpture is the tactile sensory form. So Burroughs just mimed the newspaper environment. He limited himself to visual space.
Yeah.
All right?
That's right.
And so Burroughs is limited and therefore got stopped and strapped and stuck in his little time warp. And the best thing to read is Marshall McLuhan's review of Naked Lunch in the...
That would be interesting.
Yeah, I think it's the 1964 Nation magazine. Go through the whatever the months of 1964 are and look for McLuhan's review of Naked Lunch. He nails Burroughs at that point.
Well, Burroughs, I think, is convinced that the way to psychically override the rise of the dark is to learn how to escape the body, to go discarnate. That's his basically saying, if we don't learn how to do that, we're in deep trouble. If we don't outsmart them that way.
Yeah, see, that's his mythic stage. Now, this is what I was trying to say with mythic government, is you wear your technological clothing, and the cyberpunk intuits this, and Burroughs is an archetype godfather for the cyberpunk, right?
Yeah, I guess he is.
Because they think that machines are the new language, the new technology. They look at hardware machines.
Yeah.
And they don't see the software effects of television and that. They begin to see it now because Burroughs has been operating on this premise for 30 years, so he's going to learn a few things. But they still look at hardware and as machine and don't see that machines are human. So therefore, if machines are extensions of us and human, then you can use any apparatus as a machine, including words. So he has too much of an American fixation on hardware.
Yeah.
And that's the cyberpunk bias.
Right.
You understand me, don't you?
I can grasp that.
Great.
Now, I want to point out that the Dalai Lama, when he was in town, he said that the basis for all human life is affection. And the proof he used for that is that the mother wouldn't let the child suckle her breast unless she had affection for it, and the child wouldn't suckle the mother's breast unless the child felt affection for the mother.
Well, that's...
Okay. So that relates to what Cooper, the vision he had before he was when he was shot, of wanting to cuddle with his girlfriend. Is that what you said it was?
Oh, he had the vision after he was shot.
Okay, yeah.
He was kind of dying and looking at his life and the regrets. Yes, he said he requested to make love to a woman he genuinely had affection for.
Right. See, and that's the ground for human life. And he also wanted Tibet to get its shit together.
Yeah, did you remember? Well, he wanted China to get there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But you see what I said about that particular desire? That is the private citadel of consciousness desire.
The private which?
The private citadel of consciousness, the soul part, the deepest part of yourself that's not affected by media or any technological clothing.
Yeah.
Okay? And the Dalai Lama in the old mystical tradition addresses that.
Yeah.
You know, that immortal part of yourself that Dave, the caller from Baldwin Foods, used to always bring up. And he didn't know how to relate that immortality with the mortality of matter and technology and language in the human dimension, man's world.
Yeah.
Or humankind's world. So the Dalai Lama, his bias is toward, and his expertise is in the area of the private citadel of consciousness,
Well, he says when you die, that the only part of your mind that moves on is the clear light, the part that can merge with clear light, and everything else is just psychic babble.
Yeah, the private citadel consciousness is a electromagnetic resonating energy.
Yeah, it's energetic.
Yeah, and it's
electric.
And so we extended that as an environment, and this confuses the soul.
So is that what you're saying about human scale? We don't know what the scale is.
Yeah, we're allergic. Human scale is a need for that original private senator citadel consciousness as a unification with God, which is community. So that is the deepest need in people. And it's hoiked up as we're stripped all our layers away with the electronic x-ray.
But can we do this community thing via the electric environment, or does it have to be more heart-to-heart between people who are in the same place on the planet, the same planetary eye or whatever?
Well, the solution to that is to believe in both.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so yeah. Praise Bob.
Praise Bob.
I do both.
Okay. Grab another call.
Yeah. I'll make it. Whew. Yeah, that wasn't there a ringer? Please, let them say five words. Go ahead, five words, caller.
That's all the time we got.
Okay, is it 1 minute or two?
It's 3 minutes and two, yeah.
Okay, well, we got the theme song, Mike. Was there, Kent, did you want to say something? No?
Yeah.
Follow. Let that person say something. Well, they're calling in. Just say, let them give them like 30 seconds.
No, sorry.
Okay.
We love the callers we lost tonight.
Okay,
Bob,
let's go for the fast-paced show next week. We're going to have some callers. We're going to allow that to happen.
I've tried to allow calls all night, actually, and they haven't even come
through. No, but next week during fundraising.
You've been talking too much. Yeah, I think so.
Good.
We'll try to work it
there'll
out.
There'll be short calls. There'll be pledges and wisdom.
Of course there will be.
Okay, the owls are not what they seem. The pledges are not what they seem.
listening to 88.1 CKLM.
Hi, Sherman Skolnick, Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts, 9800 Oglesby. Now, some folks don't see fit to know any history. So, for them, the clever folks who own and operate America are going to bring it all back. History as a lesson, recycled right into your face in the mass media. Some suspect there is a similarity, the 1930s and the 1990s. Then, as now, major judges owned and operated banks. They did not and do not disqualify themselves in cases involving their own financial interests. You can guess who wins. On Chicago's Old West Side was a sizable bank. The president of the bank, naturally, was a judge. It was 1932. People heard a rumor the bank was going under. Passbooks in hand, they were milling around the lobby. Nothing was happening. Then the judge, bank chief, stood up on a chair and addressed them. Now, folks, you can all go home. There is nothing to worry about. This bank is on a sound and solid basis. Boy, that did it. He spooked the standing cattle. They rushed for the withdrawal windows, knocking over the judge and his chair. It was a textbook example of mob psychology. The depositors figured things must be really bad that the banker judge had to try to calm them down. In the 1930s, local community banks were busted. The big downtown banks seemed at least to be in better shape. The difference now is your local bank is most likely in better shape than the big downtown money center banks who loaned out your money to deadbeats worldwide. You know, it's a funny thing how the press promotes financial fairy tales. So most folks are led to believe their money is somehow inside that imposing brick or stone or steel building called a bank. Not so. With the big banks, they may not actually have even one penny left of every dollar you gave them. So everyone can't actually go to the bank to get their money. It's more like a floating crap game. It's supposed to go on and on. Those who run pension funds and money market funds are alarmed. They no longer can determine whether the big banks are solvent. You see, the money center banks usually issue commercial paper, billions of dollars of it, sort of IOUs. And in the past, the money funds bought this paper without asking any questions. Well, they have practically stopped buying the commercial paper. So the biggest banks in America are up against the wall. Their IOUs are toilet paper. Now, the newspapers tell you only slivers of this, just enough to get you to urge your congressman to bail out the big bankrupt banks. Not enough news to make you understand. Savvy folks, after all, are dangerous. Facing wreck and ruin are the money funds. Ask most who have their money in mutual funds or money market funds, where is your money, actually? Most cannot answer. This is really the real emergency facing the United States. But the big dealers want to distract us with dire stories designed to let them perpetrate an oil fraud. Since the mass media are so interlocked with the banks, the press is in no position to give us real news. For example, they tell us the Chase Manhattan Bank is in trouble, but they forget to mention that the Rockefellers are no longer the major owners, so it's okay to make the Chase Bank a punching bag. The press does not give us any history of the Chase Bank, a dirty history that it is, and the history of the Rockefellers and their dirty business. They leave out the important facts. Playing again, will there be mass arrests in the United States of those who oppose the war, if there is a war? 731-1505.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford, the personable British drummer. You are listening to 88.1.
The matinees for CKLN.
Ooh, it
it's a movement and we work as we care to, play as we want to, move as we dare to. You should join too, cause it's a party. Everyone knows it's a critical life. CKLN is inspired. A movement of people everywhere. Unless the unity stops. It's a movement, make you move. You can join too, cause you move on.
FunFest, CKLN's annual fundraising drive, is just around the corner, beginning 9 a.m. Friday, October the 12th, and ending Sunday, October the 21st, with our annual wrap party at the Rivoli. FunFest is crucial for the survival of CKLN. Once a year, we ask you, our listeners, to pledge your support for CKLN, a station that supports the community all year round. Tune in to 88.1 FM from October the 12th to 21st for 10 days of challenging, inspired movement radio. FunFest 19.
No. It's a movement, make you move.
Carlsberg and CKLN present Specific Dangers, a month of jazz at the Music Gallery. On Friday, October 12th, the electrifying trio of David Pilch, Michael White, and Michelle Lambert. And with them, the saxophone duet of David Mott and Pat LaBarbera. On Saturday, October 13th, two of Canada's greatest jazz pianists, Jean Baudet and Don Thompson. On Friday and Saturday, October 19th and 20th, a weekend of chamber duets and spontaneous quartets. On Friday, pianist George McFetridge with clarinetist Robert Stevenson and bassist Mike Milligan with saxophonist Johnny Bakken. And on Saturday, the inspired pairing of jazz iconoclast Bill Grove with veteran Bob Fenton and saxophonist Rob Frame with drummer Chris McCann. That's Specific Dangers on Friday, October 12th and Saturday, October 13th. And Friday and Saturday, October 19th and 20th at 8 p.m. at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West at Dover Court.
I want to get to H.R. 5111, so the whole concept of law and lack thereof is one I want to keep in focus. We do have a listener hanging on very patiently from Palo Alto. Palo Alto, thanks for holding on. You're on live with Dan Sheehan and Sarah Nelson of the Christic Institute.
I just want to express my thanks for the work that Dan and Sarah are doing. I have two small children. It's kind of nice to see that there are some people who are looking out for the future. I'm reminded of Gandhi, and there was a word that described what he was doing, something like the truth force or something like that.
Satyagraha.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And my question involves President Bush. Like, what are his liabilities, and what kind of trail can lead to him with regard to the drug running, the Contra drug running? And I'm wondering if something like the Watergate could possibly unfold for Bush, as of course it did for Nixon.
Well, it's an interesting question. there is significant evidence demonstrating that then Vice President George Bush's national security advisor, Donald Gregg, was intimately and personally involved in the operations for the Contras in violation of the Boland Amendment. There are, for example, diary entries at the White House showing 17 separate face-to-face meetings between Donald Gregg, the national security advisor for George Bush, and Felix Rodriguez, the director of the Ilopango airlift from El Salvador to the Contras, all during the Boland Amendment period. Mm-hmm. There are, in fact, three separate meetings, face-to-face meetings, that George Bush had with Felix Rodriguez. And there are two memos that exist from Mrs. Burns, Donald Gregg's secretary, in which she has memorialized the content of the meetings between then Vice President George Bush and Felix Rodriguez, and has testified under oath to the content of those memos, saying that the content and subject matter of those meetings was the resupply of the Contras, which was expressly prohibited by the Boland Amendment during that period of time. Now, Donald Gregg, when confronted by that evidence, as people may recall, was totally confounded by that. And he said, I can't understand why those memos would have said that, because of course that would have been illegal mm-hmm. for us to do that. And his first defense position was that it must have been a typographical error on Mrs. Burns's part, his secretary. The same typographical error in two totally separate memos, both of which she had testified to under oath, was exactly what the content of the meetings was about.
Mm-hmm.
And then he later seized upon a much better explanation, he thought, saying that it must have been copters that he was talking about, and that she just misunderstood it when he said that the subject matter was the resupply of copters. Now, nobody really believed him when he said that. And then once it had been sort of unequivocally established that Donald Gregg, the national security advisor for Vice President Bush at the time, was intimately involved and knowledgeable about this criminal enterprise that was functioning, when Donald Gregg was confronted about that and said, you know, what did George Bush say when you told him about these activities? He said, oh, I didn't feel that they were important.